want to welcome you to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. This podcast is coming out of the Trauma Informed Educators Network Facebook group. I am so looking forward to talking to people globally about their trauma informed journey. As the principal of Fall Hamilton Elementary School, a trauma informed school in Nashville, Tennessee, I have learned that this is not a destination, and it truly is a process of learning and adjusting. So this podcast will be speaking to guests all over the world about people who are just starting their journeys and people have been on this journey for many, many years. So I hope you enjoy our guests. I hope you learn something just as I am. And welcome to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. All right, this is episode number 40 of the podcast. Today's guest is LaToya Nelson. She's a trauma-informed educator who is focused on healing-centered learning. We'll get into what that means. She's a caregiver of three children and a wife of one, introverted, lover of all things advocacy, and unicorns. She does her best to normalize blended same-sex families. Humanizing children is her jam. Her daughter is her reason. And she is the reason this field chose her, so she can enter a classroom where teachers can meet her needs and others who have shared similar experiences. So this is what LaToya had to say. LaToya, we are here, and we are here for a great conversation tonight. And as you know, I fought over an hour traffic to get here and was drastically, crazily running around and like grabbed a water and ran up here with a snack bar and to make sure that we're here. Of course, we had a little technical difficulties, which is not uncommon. But I'm really glad to have you here. I know we've had some conversations and you are helping us. When I say us, I mean Paradigm Shift with this year's conference. So I'm so excited to have you as a real live practitioner in the classroom, right? Because it seems like the more we talk, the more people are outside of the realm, and those experts are amazing. But I think we learn the most from those people, and by those, I mean you and I, on the ground who are meeting the needs of kids on a day-to-day basis when it is challenging the most. So let's hear it. What's the LaToya story? Tell us about you.
Well, I'm LaToya. I'm currently living in Maryland. I grew up in Philadelphia. Right now, I am a caretaker to three children. And one of them, and I always say it's her story to tell, but she is the reason I entered into this work. Kindergarten was a nightmare. Preschool was a nightmare. Just the policies and practices, things we experienced as a family, things she had to navigate as a student in the system. They were really hard. And I just kind of, as a parent, hit a wall where I felt like I was crumbling and I didn't know what to do and how to navigate it. And I was like, wow, this feels really terrible. I wish that someone knew how to help me because no one knew how to help me, which in turn they didn't know how to help her. And it was just this constant tug and pull. And so one day I was in school getting a master's. At that time, my focus was in special education. And then all of a sudden, this random, like, you know how you get those little notifications in your email popped up about this new program called Trauma-Informed Education. And I kind of read a little bit about it, decided to pursue it. And then I kind of fell into teaching. That wasn't what I went to school for. But nice. I ended up kind of just stumbling into it. And that's kind of how I got here. And it's just been my goal, my purpose to kind of connect with as many children as I can and kind of advocate for them as they learn how to advocate for themselves.
You know, such a powerful statement that you probably say often, but is so very, very important because, you know, at my school, we are a leader in me school and we teach the 7 habits of highly effective people. And the 8th habit that most people don't know about is find your voice. And I always say one of the primary focuses of our school is to leave a student who can advocate for themselves and others. And that is habit 8, right? So tell me, I've always been intrigued by your use of healing-centered education. When you were talking and when you use that terminology, what are you referring to when you say healing-centered education?
So I think what happens, and I think you and I discussed this before with trauma-informed work, is we kind of get caught up in the why and the mitigating factors of trauma, but it's like that's the stopping point. That's where it ends, you know. Oh, we figured out the why. We figured out, you know, what's happening and kind of those things. And what can we do to prevent it? What can we do to respond? Okay, but once we've done that, then what, you know? And I feel like children spend so much of their day with us. They spend a lot of time with us, a lot of time during the year, a lot of time in their day. And there has to be an extension. So now that we figured out the why, how can we help them move forward? How can we help them go from there? And so that's kind of what I mean when I say focus on healing center education. So no more focusing on the pain, because that pain is going to be there. It's something that's there. It's something that exists.
Right.
But how can we get them to move through that pain so they can find their joy, and so that they can become not just their trauma, but feel like a human, and not like someone's trying to constantly fix them.
Man, powerful, right? And I think we both agree we're not fixing kids, we're fixing systems. Kids aren't broken, right? Trauma's not new. Trauma is not a new thing. Trauma's been around as long as human beings have been around.
Absolutely.
And I think what you're saying is we have to look past the trauma and look through the healing, because I have a saying with my students, and when I say my students, I mean all the students of school. Once I'm your principal, always your principal. Doesn't matter if you're 35, doesn't matter if you're 5. If you need me, I'm going to be there. And I think that's what it's seeing through with kids. They have to know that we're there and we're present, whether it's now, literally, or in the future. And that's what I hear you saying. So tell us about what does this humanization of education, because you know, you and I talked and it inspired me to like make a little graphic that said it's over time to humanize education. When we talk about humanizing education, and I want you to go deep in here, what is not humanized about it? I think you and I are going to agree. And what are we going to do differently?
I think nothing about it embraces the fact that we are human. You know, there's this idea that somehow when you enter the school building, everything about you has disappeared and you are supposed to just like turn on just like that, you know? And there's a lot of course we want to have boundaries as educators, but there's a lot of like, I'm the teacher, this is my teacher person. And there's just kind of like this separation. And so a lot of times children don't get to see the true authentic person. And so that's where a lot of that fear about making mistakes and growing and different things of that nature kind of come in. So when I say humanized education, I mean for children to bring their true authentic selves. They don't have to leave anything at the door, because just because they walked in doesn't mean that everything that happened has automatically just turned off. And it's the same for us. Right now I'm struggling. And so when I'm going into my classroom, I can't just like, oh, make it disappear. And so I try to be extremely vulnerable with my students in a way that's not trauma dumping or emotional dumping, but saying, you know, right now I'm really having a hard time. This is how I'm coping through it. I appreciate you being there for me, but also giving them the space to have those same emotions. I think we get really caught up in education and trying to truly, truly fix kids as if they are somehow broken, as if they are somehow machines. And that is not the case. I think we reduce them almost to the basic instincts of survival. And I think that, can be traumatic in itself. And we don't acknowledge some of the trauma that comes from school. And so when I'm saying humanized education, I mean acknowledging that school can be traumatic, acknowledging that sometimes we are gatekeeping a system that has produced trauma and continues to hold some of that trauma. And once we acknowledge that, we can move forth into healing.
And, you know, I don't have the person's name here, but we have a participant on the live from Facebook that says I'm a first grade teacher here. Wow. I met a mother today who is in this space of pain and confusion, which I could embrace her and fill her with this knowledge and let her know I'm here for her. She's not alone. I think when you say humanize education, I'm looking at the scope of everything, whether it's from the educators in the building, because we certainly dehumanize educators, the children, and for sure the parents. I think for some reason in this work, we forget that trauma has happened to our parents. And I'm going to speak from this experience. In schools, when they were younger. And so we are having to shift paradigms that are extensive. And so I think this scope of rehumanizing education is one we have to take seriously.
Absolutely.
So from a parent's perspective, I heard what you said earlier. Tell me, as connected to the person who typed that, what are some of those experiences that you have had as a parent that and I don't want you to tell like specifics, but right. that made you go, whoa, hold on a minute. Let's take a pause.
I mean, so there's this idea. I just had this conversation today with a colleague. There's this idea that children are somehow an extension of the adults in their lives, as if they are not their own people with their own stories, and that somehow their behavior, so to speak, I use that word loosely, is an indication of how well you parent or how well you teach. And so I was often made to feel ashamed for the things that my daughter was experiencing. And she was often made to feel ashamed rather than understood or empathized with for the very real and traumatic things that she had experienced. And at 4, 5, 6 years old, she didn't have the words to share. She was made to feel bad about experiencing those things. And as a parent, when I got those constant phone calls, it became so bad that I would see the number and I would almost have a panic attack. My hands would shake, my palms would sweat, my heart was racing because I was like, what are they going to tell me now? How are they going to make me feel now? And I did not like the way I was afraid. I was afraid for her. I was afraid for myself. And it just was not a good experience to feel like this place where she's going every single day has reduced her to almost some kind of monster is what they made her out to be, as if she was somehow unfixable, unreachable, unlovable, and that it was because of me and my lack of attention to her that she was this way is how it felt.
You know, and I think a part of that is I had this conversation with an educator yesterday. Unrelenting positive regard, assuming, making the basic assumption everyone is doing the best they can in the moment. I think if we as educators can grasp on to that idea, and I'm a parent, and I served as a foster parent for almost 2 years. LaToy, when I tell you I feel you, I feel you. Where even children who we were simply being caregivers for, it was almost as if there was a reflection of who I am as a parent or an adult, right? Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where I felt very similar, like, well, no kidding why he was upset, right? You're using a clip down chart and publicly humiliating him, mm-hmm. and he already feels enough disconnection from what it just radiated me, right? And I think that that's where, as educators, we have to see ourselves as holistic support systems. You know what? I've sat on a parent's couch 3 weeks ago when they had to sit down and tell their news to their kids, because they knew they could call me and I would be there. That is no type of privy empathy. I need an award. No, but we've got to see ourselves in that light as being there for a parent. So let's talk about a positive, because you know we can really ramp on these bad experiences.
Absolutely.
And I can easily get down there. Tell me about some educators as a parent that you've experienced, and I also want to hear about parents that you've experienced or educators that you've experienced that have inspired you around what we know as relationship rehumanizing educational approaches.
My daughter, when we moved to Maryland a few years back, my daughter got a really great teacher who was like, I am only going to call you just so you're in the know. But I am going to kind of navigate and deal with the things here because I'm trying to build a relationship and a rapport with her. So that was one of the really good experiences that I had. As far as much of my framework comes around, I'm sure you're familiar with like Rita Pearson, who I absolutely adore. I draw a lot of my inspiration from her, to be honest, because when I think about her TED Talk, which I remember seeing for the first time, and I was like, wow, how simple, but how powerful to say, well, you got two right. You know, you didn't get them all wrong. You got two right. And I had never, it's so simple, but, you know, we're just taught to teach a certain way and we were just disciplined a certain way. But really, that was really what started to shift my lens and how I viewed the work that I do.
And, you know, there's a lot of controversy and there's a lot of pushback on the word trauma-informed education. And I get it, right? Because it does insinuate a deficit idea. But what you're talking about is seeing things in a positive way, seeing things in a asset-driven way. And I think, to be honest, when I saw that TED Talk too, and you know, she made that classic statement of children don't learn from adults they don't like. And I 100% believe that. I think the people who Absolutely. Impacted me in education as a student, whether in elementary, middle, high school, or even in graduate work, were the people that I felt actually cared about me as a human. And so I think that's powerful stuff that we have to have a discussion about. I'm going to put up a question here that you and I can tackle. We can both tackle this one because it's a big one, right? And it was, I'm a junior and senior high school teacher here. What do you do about a child that refuses help to overcome trauma? Wow, that's a weighted one, right?
Yes, that is.
And I want you to start, and I'm just going to fuel your fire, or I'm okay. going to jump in too. What okay. do you say to a question to the person that's listening live? What do you say to a question in that regard?
I think it's important to realize that we're always healing. We're always overcoming trauma, and that the trauma didn't happen overnight, so the healing is not going to happen overnight. And it may look like they're refusing, but much of what happens when you experience any sort of trauma is that trust is just decimated. And that the quote is so simple and we hear it all the time. It's easy to break trust, hard to earn it. You have to truly focus on connection and rapport and just viewing that child as human. When we use the word help overcome, it's almost like that dehumanization, I need to fix you kind of thing. And I think that it's important to recognize that all you can do is be your true, authentic self, truly try and connect with them, let them know that you care, you are there to be consistent, so that they can start the process of healing. Whatever happened to them, whatever they're going through, they may not even have they may not be overcoming it because they could still be in it. We're constantly going through periods of stressors in our lives. I mean, we're in an ongoing traumatic event currently. And we experience, you know, one piece of it and then another facet of it. And then it's kind of ongoing. So I think it's really important to recognize that you have to validate them first. And you are not trying to fix them. They need to know that they are not broken. There is nothing broken about them. What happened to them was hard, and what happened to them was not okay, but they are not broken. It is not their fault. Their feelings are valid, whether it's anger, whether it's shame. I think we kind of get into this thing where we think that children are only supposed to experience emotions that are positive. Negative emotions exist for a reason. They are there. We have to feel those things. And that child needs to feel what they are feeling so that they can move past and find their joy.
You know, and I'm gonna add on to that is, and I'm gonna give you an absolute experience that I have that I just recently experienced. We had a student who had suffered an extreme loss in front of them while they were present. And that happened on November 1st, 2017. And I know because I held this student for almost 45 minutes as they arrived to school. And that changed me forever as a human being. And just this week, over 4 years later, this child has chosen and given the privilege of having conversations with adults at Fall Hamilton, my school, about what happened. We didn't ask. We don't ask. But at the point in which he was ready to express his feelings and emotions, it took 4 years. And I think I want to reiterate that this is not a sprint process of healing focused education. This takes a long time in some instances. We have to understand that children respond in different ways. No single child responds in the same way. And so being present, I reinforce what you said. Be present. That's all you can be. And be there in the present for whomever you're trying to process that through. I also want to say another thing, LaToya, that kind of brought it into me. Today, a student came to me and she had a drawing that she had done in art. And there were 6 or 7 emotions, everything from frustrated to happy to sad to distracted. And she was telling me about these are her emotions that she feels. And I said, you know what? I feel all of those every single day. And she said, well, which one do you feel the most? And I said, without doubt, distracted. I constantly feel distracted. I'm running from one way. And she goes, me too. I said, I tell you what, let's go around the building and ask some adults. And so we stopped every adult over the course of about 10 minutes and just said, hey, look at these. How many do you feel today? All of them. Which one do you feel the most? Distracted. Distracted. Look, she be bought back to this class like, hey, I am perfectly normal. Because I think what you said is we have to normalize emotions. We have to normalize it and name it, right? I think naming emotions when we feel them in front of children is absolutely imperative. I'm frustrated. I'm irritated. I'm angry. I'm happy. I'm ecstatic. And it's something that I think schools could do more around social and emotional health development. So what do you see post COVID? What do you think post COVID is going to be like from an educator's perspective? And what are some steps to move forward in this healing centered educational concept and idea?
I think post-COVID, we're going to have a lot of work to do. We have spent much of our time in isolation. And one of the things I'm noticing as my kids are shifting back into the classroom is they feel really anxious because they've gone from kind of just being in their little bubbles to being in large groups of people. And so I think we're going to have to really be flexible. We are going to have to really be willing to break the mold and understand that what may have worked before may not work now. And it's just going to take a lot of patience, a lot of validating, a lot of patience, and a lot of connection. Really, truly connecting and being yourself and getting to know kids and getting to know things that they're into, getting to know what they're feeling. Like you said, naming those emotions, giving them opportunity and space to name them, to feel them, and truly just immerse themselves back into the environment because they've been gone for so long.
And I know this is insane, but I'm insanely optimistic. I think there is so much opportunity. We're back, right? We're back in person. About 55% of the students at my school are back. 45% are still virtual. I think that there is so much opportunity in front of us as practitioners to finally disrupt some of these archaic ideas of what students bring when it looks like quote unquote behavior, what I call communication, right? And how we respond, because at this point, we've all been impacted, of course, on different levels and different ways, but we can now start having a conversation, LaToya, on a global scale that a lot of us have been having for many, many years. It's like, yes, stress impacts you. Yes, global pandemics absolutely do. So let's talk about what we should do differently, right? And I think that that's to me, the positive that's going to come out of this is that Absolutely. We can actually start having conversations that we've been having in small pockets for years. So I want to get to one topic that I love to talk about. And I love to talk about it in that I want to make sure I'm always on that cusp of making sure I keep myself in check. And that's this idea of privempathy or the savior complex, right?
Absolutely.
I would love to hear your perspective, because when you say we're not fixing broken kids, right, then that takes that idea that I am coming to save you. And I think we have to get to past the point of we are coming to save the children. Talk to me about what your thoughts around that idea of privempathy or having that savior complex when we go to work with children.
I think that goes back into what we talked about as far as humanizing education, right? Because if we're bringing our true authentic selves into the classroom, we know that we are always healing. We are always learning. We are always growing. If we humanize children and recognize that we can learn so much from them, that gives us the humility to realize that we are not some like superior who is above learning and growing and healing. It's this ongoing process. So it's a lot of moving from, you know, what's wrong with you? What happened to you? To what's right with you? How can I learn from you? How can I grow with you?
I love that.
And I think that's kind of, once you're able to kind of acknowledge where you are and where you need to grow and how you need to heal, you can recognize that you're in an ongoing healing process. And that takes away this idea that you have to fix someone. Because none of us are broken. We are always experiencing different things that we're learning and growing from. We're just like a plant, you know? If a stem breaks off of a plant, I can repot it and it can grow again. And so we're always constantly healing and on the path of evolution and growing as a person. And I feel like once you can acknowledge that, then you can take away like, oh, I need to fix them. I need to change them, because you are growing, learning, and evolving right alongside them.
You know, I've always said the kids that I get the privilege of working with have always taught me more than I felt I've ever left them with. From when I was an EL teacher, a self-contained fourth grade EL teacher 15 years ago, to the students I get to see every single day. To me, it's a privilege that I get to see them and that they welcome me with a smile. And they're why I get up, not because I'm doing anything for them, but because they inspire me every single day. And I hope as educators, if you don't feel that way, that you get into a place and in a culture of a school that makes you feel that way. Because not only do the kids inspire, but the adults that I get to work with every single day do the same thing. Especially today on April Fool's Day, when we got to pull all of the jokes on our fourth graders, which I will tell you, you should check out my Facebook page and look at some of the amazing things my creative fourth grade teachers pulled off, because it was remarkable on what they did. So let's get a little deeper, right? If you're talking systems changes, because we've both said multiple times, we have to change systems, not kids. Kids aren't broken, the systems. What are some levers? What are some big levers that you feel like could be paradigm shifting for our field in education?
I always say that our system is not necessarily broken. It's operating the way that it was intended to. And I think much of it is that we have to reimagine how we view things, right? So this might have worked a long time ago, but our kids are different. Their needs are different. What we need as educators is different. One of the biggest things for me is the shame that children feel often in school. The shame from simple things like, oh, I didn't raise my hand, or, oh, I didn't read out loud, or I'm not as outgoing or extroverted. And so there's a lot of shame that comes with some of the ways that we interact with children in school. And so I think one of the biggest shifts will be for us to look at children, not as children, but human first. They are human before they are children.
So powerful. I'm going to go back and I'm going to dig a little deeper on something that you said, because when you said it, it kind of, it just smacked me, because you're 100% right. And when you say this, I want you to dig deeper. When you say the system is working exactly how it was designed to, let's really dig into that, because you're right. When we look at historical context, right, and we're talking all the way back. All the way back. And you know, we've got several people from New Zealand listening, and I know we have a huge listenership in the UK. So we're going to even go way back then, right?
Way back.
That's how old our education system is. So when you said it's designed and it's working exactly, what do you mean by that? Because I think I know, but I would love to hear your perspective.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when school was created, it was never created for the children that it serves. It was never created for girl children. It was never created for Black children, Indigenous children. It was never created for anyone other than white male students. And much of those students, we were creating workers. We were not creating people to go out and collaborate and connect. We were creating workers, people to go out, work in a factory, work for someone else, and kind of just abide by the rules and listen. And so much of school, from everything, raise your hand and go to the bathroom, 20-minute, 30-minute lunch break, walk in a straight line, all of it was centered around prepping you for that line of work. And it was designed specifically for that. And so then you go into this shift where you're adding different people. And it's like, well, I don't want to change it, because if I allow you to question me, if I allow you this opportunity to expand beyond this, then I am now digging myself into something I don't know I want to go there. Because that's going to open a big can of worms, and I need you to be a worker. I need you to not question me. I need you to be produced for me. I need you to be a machine. I need you to produce product for me, because if you don't produce product for me, then I don't make any money.
Fact. And I don't know if you know, Latoya, I'm a white male. I don't know if you know that, but I will tell you, yes, I agree 100%. And at the end of the day, we're trying to do the same thing we've always done, but the game has changed, and it should have changed a long time ago. right? I just had this conversation even in the last 20, 30 years since I've been in high school and I graduated in 1995. The world has changed. My perspective has changed. Technology has changed. Accessibility has changed. Careers have changed. But when we're talking historical context, right, unfortunately, some of those systems and structures have not changed. We know without doubt, data shows it clear, there's a disproportionality of consequences for children of, and not just boys, of color. I want to kick that misnomer out. All children of color. There's this discrepancy that continues to rampage education that nobody seems to want to look at. And let me tell you, LaToya, I'm a white principal of a school of 85% of my kids are black and brown. And if I don't take notice of what our data is and look at the big picture, then I'm contributing. And I know that. And it's why we've eliminated exclusionary practices. Not an option anymore. Because we have to continue to build kids, humans first, kids second. And whatever they choose and however they find their voice is what we want them to do. We call it meeting your fullest potential or identifying your genius, right? But isn't it interesting we still use the words like college and career ready, right?
I mean, isn't it? Insane. It drives me bonkers. And I have that conversation. We just had that conversation with my students. He's like, well, my mom's always like, I have to go to college. I'm like, I mean, I can't tell you not to tell you, your mom can't tell you that, but you can actually do what you want. And so there's just this big push. We use such coded language, and it's all has an underlying tone and underlying meaning. And it's harmful. It truly is. It's harmful. And I think I said it before, we don't recognize how violent some of the practices are. It's like a killjoy sometimes going into this system, because it's like, I know that Bettina Love says it in her book about like spirit murdering, spirit murdering. You go in, you know, think of kindergartners, they're bright eyed, they're so excited. They get that first backpack.
You're right. And they're fired up, right? They come in, they get the backpack, they're fired up. And then, I think you're muted. I think your mic came undone. But yes, and they come in with the backpack, and then we teach them school.
I just had this conversation with my colleague, and my heart broke because her baby, I told her, I said, your baby is experiencing a killjoy. You know, they're telling her, oh, she's five. And they're telling her, oh, she's behind. She doesn't know these words. She's so distraught. I said, she's five. She's like, but she's five. She said, but she's five. She's five. Yes, she's going to be distracted. She probably doesn't want to read and she's not interested. She literally said, this is boring to me because you're moving too fast and I am confused. That was enough said in itself. when she said that to you and you chose to ignore her, but instead of accepting that feedback, mm-hmm. you decided that she was distracted. That she was behind, that she was not comprehending, instead of accepting the fact that she said, you're moving too fast.
I mean, think about if we could really actually take feedback from our students. I mean, being like legitimate feedback. Imagine how things would be different, right? And I always find it interesting that educators like to provide a lot of feedback, especially to their administrator. Trust me, I know this, right? And I take it and I listen and we adjust. If we could do the same for our students, and we do on a lot of levels at my school, but not to the extent it needs to be done, how their worlds would change and how inspired we could. Now you're getting me fired up. So I'm already thinking, what can we do next year around student feedback, right? Like, because we've got to. And I think when a child uses their voice in that manner and we try to quiet it, that has mm-hmm. nothing to do with the child. It has everything yep. with doing my own personal self-protection, because yep. you're a child and you should be you should not be listened to. You should be listening to me. But yep, such a powerful man, such a powerful piece.
I always said my fear in becoming a teacher was like, it can be such ego-centered work. And it's really important for me that I remind myself that I'm human and that I am servicing other humans and that this is not about me. What my students learn, what they grow, that is all them. I am facilitating, I am guiding, but it's no indication of anything about me. And I think if teachers are able to remove their ego from it and not take things, you know, we can be more receptive to that feedback. But the ego has to be removed because this is no indication. And I know that, again, that goes back to systems operating. You know, teachers are like, well, I've got to get this box checked. Am I highly effective? Am I effective? How is this going to impact me? So it just kind of reinforces, it's like a trickle down effect. And so that's that boils back to that humanizing education and dismantling the system that was never, you know, intended for what we are doing right here and in the now.
I love the comment from Melanie, and I put it up there. Apparently, New Zealand is representing tonight because we are, yes, this evening, because we got a lot of people that are interacting from New Zealand. It's, power sharing is big here. And I think that's so important. Voice and the power sharing, really, it isn't even sharing. It's a collective community learning, problem solving.
Absolutely.
And that's the way it should be. And so when there is a Secretary for Education coming up, we have Cordova right now. I will be voting for LaToya to be the Secretary of Education because if you could just rule the world and do a wand, I think we could do so much better because what you're saying is valid. We have got to think differently about how our classrooms are set up, what we're asking kids to do, the type of collaboration we're asking them to do. I'm going to be honest and tell you, I have one classroom that's full flexible seating. There's these bouncy donuts. There are these yoga balls. I mean, I go in there and transparent. Some of the students in the class struggled, and they struggled for a long time. And all of a sudden, the struggle is almost completely gone. But they're bouncing, they're moving, they're enjoying themselves. Those are the little things that don't take much that can allow a kid to move and build success because it's imperative we shift it. And I also want to say one more thing that resonated with me. FYI, LaToya, I was not a straight A student until grad school. Like, literally. I never got straight A's. My ACT score was not strong, right? It's not. And people told me I was never going to do anything. And I remember standing on a stage just outside of London, speaking to people, thinking I was told my whole elementary and middle and high school career to be quiet. And the irony that it felt. And boy, as vindictive as I should not be, it was glorious.
And I'm sure it felt great.
And I hope one day every student that has been quieted gets to experience that moment of true liberation and, how do I say this, a figurative 20% wave. You know how many fingers are up if it's 20%. To all the people that said they weren't or they didn't or their scores weren't high enough or their test scores weren't and an honor to the teachers who believed in them. Because at the end of the day, it really only takes one caring adult. That's it. One. Every child is one caring adult away from being a success. That's it. And I think we have to understand that we all can be that caring adult. So at the last question I ask everybody, and I told you 45 minutes was going to go real fast. What do you want educators to know from one educator to another, to all the educators that will listen to this? What do you want them to know from you right now?
What I want them to know is that you are a healer. You don't need some sort of certificate. You don't need some sort of education to be a healer. Our classrooms can be healing-centered spaces. I want you to know that it's not a list that you check off, that this work is ongoing, that healing is ongoing. And part of being a healer is that you are constantly healing. You are healing that child in you that might have been silenced in school. You are healing that child in you that might have felt shame about grades or about not being enough. And as you do that work, you change your mindset, you shift your mindset into how you interact with your students and even with your kids at home if you have children, and humanize them. And as you do that, there's a collective healing. Healing is interdependent. And if we can really connect and understand that, we can shift, begin to shift, because this is going to take time. We can begin to shift education.
Thank you so much for being on here, for sharing some vulnerability, for always giving me more wisdom. And to the listeners, I apologize if my frustration at the end and my celebration of proving people wrong got into the way of maybe putting a filter in your eyes. But at the end of the day, this is about changing systems that were designed to work exactly how they are, so that all kids have the platform and ability to use their voice in a way to advocate for themselves and others. So LaToya and I want to make sure that you know how to follow her. If you want a daily, almost daily, if not every other day, inspiration, you need to follow her on Instagram. And where else can they find you? What's your Instagram? Where else can they find you on social media?
I am on Instagram at Raising Resilience. There's two underscores between Raising and Resilience. I am on Twitter. I need to get better about posting on Twitter at LC Nelson Brown. And I do have Clubhouse as well, which is still LC Nelson Brown. I'm hoping to have some conversations there, open rooms, have open conversations. So follow me on those things and just get little tidbits of wisdom.
I did my first Clubhouse experience, and wow, it's super cool and super awesome and a great way to engage with people from all over. I don't have an iPhone and I don't have Apple products other than my computer, so I've got to get an iPad or something. But anyways, I had to borrow my son's just to be able to get on there. But also, LaToya is on our national conference planning committee. The Trauma Informed Educators Network conference is July 19th to the 21st, 2021. Registration is open. It is only $125 for all 3 days. We have 48 sessions. We have two amazing keynote speakers. We have one expert panel, and we have a whole virtual group of disruptors who are ready to unite to move this work across our world. And yes, it is an international conference. So please check that out. You can check that out on paradigmshift.com. If you want to follow me, I am Principal List. I on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Matthew Portell on Facebook. And I also want to say a shout out to one of our partners for the conference, which is Stop It Solutions. It is an amazing app of self-reporting and it's using a safeguard technology in education. What they do is they link students with caring adults to prevent preventable and uncover the unseen and intervene on an imminent at earliest possible point. And so it is a way kids can reach out for help without having to risk themselves, no matter what situation they're in. So we're really excited to partner with them on the conference. And as always, please, please, please continue to wash your hands and wear a mask.